Brian Zhen from China. As a coke addict myself, I'm excited to report to you, our worldwide promoter in chief, that the cokes in Beijing taste just as wonderful as in Omaha. As an ex-Zen monk, today I feel like visiting the Buddha of the financial world. We have an investment club with a name that ends in .com, believe it or not, which tells you that the frenzy .com friends even seduced Zen monks when we tried to follow you. We find that Mrs. Susan Buffett used to send Zen Buddhism books to her sorority sisters. That's probably why she always has a peaceful smile due to her low expectation of life, which according to Buddha is full of sufferings. But Mr. Munger would tell me that Susan's smile is because you, as the husband, exceeded her low expectations.
That's right.
Yeah. And her father's even lower expectations.
Anyway, my question is, did Susan also send those Zen books to your office or your bedroom? And if you have read those books, what are the key ideas that contributed to your investment Tao, which even made sense to secluded, narrow-minded Zen monks like me? Thanks for the financial enlightenments you've given us today.
Thank you. I sent those books on to Charlie, so I'll let him answer.
Actually, I tend to be a follower of Confucius. And I think this room is full of Confucian values. You know, if the first law of Confucianism is filial piety, particularly toward elderly males, you can see why I like that system.
Area four.
Good afternoon, Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger. My name is Kevin Truitt from Chicago. I have three questions for you. Mr. Munger, at last year's shareholder meeting, you stated that you didn't feel that the concept of the cost of capital made true economic sense. Would you explain why you felt this way and what you would do to replace it with anything? My second question is to Mr. Buffett. You've stated the importance of an occasional big idea. How were you able to, in fact, tell when you had a big idea? And my third question, Mr. Buffett, you have talked about the importance of the franchise and sustainable competitive advantage. Companies like Kellogg and Campbell Soup are companies that most people would have said had those qualities. However, over time, those qualities were lost as a result of a change in consumer taste. What gives you confidence that the same things won't happen to Coke or Gillette?
Charlie?
Well,
cost of capital.
Cost of capital first. Obviously, considerations of cost are important in business. And obviously, opportunity costs, which is a doctrine of economics, really a doctrine of lifesmanship, are also very important. And we've always had that kind of basic thinking. Of course, capital isn't free. And of course, you can figure cost of capital when you're borrowing money, or at least you can figure cost of loans. But the theorists had to develop some theory for what equity cost. And there they just went bonkers. They said if you earned 100% on capital because you had some marvelous business, your cost of capital was 100%. And therefore, you shouldn't look at any opportunity that delivered a lousy 80%. That is the kind of thinking which came out of the capital assets pricing models and so forth that I've always considered inanity. What is Berkshire's cost of capital? We have this damn capital. It just keeps multiplying and multiplying. What is its cost? If you have perfectly good old-fashioned doctrines like opportunity cost. You know, at any given time when we consider an investment, we have to compare it to the best alternative investment we have at that time. We had perfectly good old-fashioned ideas that are very basic to use, but they weren't good enough for these modern theorists. Mm-hmm. So they invented all this ridiculous mathematics, which concluded that the companies that made the most money had the highest costs of capital. Well, all I can say is it's not for us. Now, the other half of that question I leave for Mr. Buffett.
Yeah. What you find, of course, is that the cost of capital is about 0.25% below the return promised by any deal that the CEO wants to do. Very simple. We have three questions on capital, with capital is around, and leaving aside whether we want to borrow money, which we generally don't want to do. And one is, does it make it more sense to pay it out to the shareholders than to keep it within the company? Sub-question on that is, if we pay it out, is it better off to do it via repurchases or by a dividend? The test for whether we pay it out in dividends is, can we create more than a dollar of value within the company with that dollar than paying it out? And you never know the answer to that, but so far the answer, is judged by results, is yes, we can. And we think that prospectively we can, but that's a hope on our part, and it's justified to some extent by past history, but it's not a certainty. Once we cross that threshold, then do we repurchase stock? Well, obviously, if you can buy your stock at a significant discount from conservatively calculated intrinsic value and you can buy it in reasonable quantity, that's a use for capital. Beyond that, then the question becomes, if you have the capital, you think you can create more than a dollar, how do you create the most with the least risk? And that gets to business risk. It doesn't get to any calculation of the volatility. I don't know the risk in See's Candy is measured by its stock volatility because the stock hasn't been outstanding since 1972. Does that mean I can't determine how risky a business sees is because we don't have a daily quote on it? No, I can determine it by looking at the business and the competitive environment in which it operates and so on. So once we cross the threshold of deciding that we can deploy capital so as to create more than a dollar of present value for every dollar retained, then it's just a question of doing the most intelligent thing that you can find. That is the cost of every deal we do is measured by the second best deal that's around at a given time, including more, doing more of some of the things we're already in. And I have listened to cost of capital discussions at all kinds of corporate board meetings, everything else, and I've never found anything that made very much sense in it, except for the fact that it's what they learned in business school, and it's what the consultants talked about, and most of the board members would nod their head without knowing what the hell was going on. And that's been my history with the cost of capital. Now, moving on to the big ideas, you know when you've got a big idea, and I can't tell you, you know, exactly what happens within your nervous system or brain at that time, but we've had a relatively few big ideas, good ideas, over the years. I don't know how many you think we've had in aggregate, probably in career, maybe 25 each or something.
If you took the top 15 out of Berkshire Hathaway, most of you people wouldn't be here. So roughly one every 2 years.
Yeah, one every year or two. And sometimes there'll be a bunch of them, like in 1973 and 4. But the problem is, for us, is that big now really means big. I mean, it has to be billions of dollars to move the needle very much at Berkshire. But I would say that when I would turn those pages 50 years ago in the Moody's manuals, I would know when I hit a big idea. I've got a half a dozen of them that I keep the Xeroxes from those reports around from 50 years ago, just because it was so obvious that they were incredible. And that happens every now and then. When I met Lorimer Davidson, you know, in end of January 1951, and he spent 4 hours or 5 hours with me explaining Geico, I knew it was a big idea. 8 months later, probably 10 months later, I wrote an article to the Commercial and Financial Chronicle on the security I like best. It was a big idea. When I found Western Insurance Securities, I knew it was a big idea. You know, I couldn't put millions of dollars into it, but I didn't have millions, so it didn't make any difference. And we've seen things subsequently, and we'll see, you know, if we have a normal lifespan, we'll see a few more before we get done. But I can't tell you that exactly how, I can't tell you exactly what transpires in my mind that says, you know, flashes a neon sign up that says this is a big idea. What happens with you, Charlie? Actually, I have a real system. My idea of a truly big idea is one I get and I call Charlie and he only says no, rather than that's the worst idea I've ever heard of. But if he just says no, it's a hell of an idea.
Yeah. You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it, and where it rarely is presented to you. And I think that's something you have to prepare for over a long period. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind. And I don't think you can teach people in 2 minutes how to have a prepared mind. But that's the game.
Things we learned 40 years ago, though, will help in recognize the next big idea.
And on opportunity cost, going back to that, the current freshman economics text, which is sweeping the country, has right in practically the first page, and it says, all intelligent people should think primarily in terms of opportunity cost. And that's obviously correct. But it's very hard to teach business based on opportunity cost. It's much easier to teach the capital assets pricing model, where you can just punch in numbers and outcome numbers. And therefore, people teach what is easy to teach instead of what is correct to teach. It reminds me of Einstein's famous saying. He says, everything should be made as simple as possible, but no more simple.
Write that down. You asked an interesting question about franchises, too, and mentioned Campbell's Soup and Kellogg. I am no expert on that, but I would say that just based on my general observation over the years is that the problems there came from two different things. I think that the problems with cereal, ready-to-eat cereal, were not so much changes in taste or consumption patterns, but I think they made it just push their pricing too far to the point that they lost market share without having the moat that they thought they had, as opposed to the General Mills cereals and the General Food cereals and all of that sort of thing. I mean, if your pricing really gets out of whack, and people regard Wheaties or Grape Nuts in the same category as they regard Kellogg's Corn Flakes, you know, you're going to lose share. And once you start losing share, it's hard to get back. Problems with soup, I think, relate more to lifestyle. I think that it's become a little less, it fits in a little less well with current lifestyles maybe than 40 years ago. Soft drinks. The consumption of soft drinks, I don't have the figures here, but I would wager that in 110 years, the per capita soft drinks has gone up virtually every year throughout that history. I mean, it's now close to 30% of U.S. consumption of liquids. So if the average American has about 64 ounces of liquids a day, you're talking about, say, 18 ounces of that being soft drinks, and 43% of that 18, or almost 8 ounces a day, being Coca-Cola products. In other words, 1/8 of all the liquid, man, woman, and child in the United States take in, comes from Coca-Cola products. But that has gone up virtually, well, throughout the world, it's gone up on a per capita basis, you know, almost since soft drinks were discovered. That people, I would say that that trend is almost impossible to reverse on a worldwide basis. I mean, there's so much potential in countries where per capita consumption is like, I think it's, maybe 8 per capita, which is 8-ounce servings, they talk in terms, 64 ounces a year. So you have 1/50th of the consumption per capita on Coke products in some important countries that you have here. I just don't see it as being, you can push pricing too far. I mean, there comes a point, depends on the country in which you're doing it, but and depends even on areas within the country in which you do it. But if you establish too wide a differential between Coke and a private label product, you will change consumption patterns somewhat. Not huge, but enough so that you don't want to do it. But I don't think you'll see. It's interesting. Coffee has gone down every year. People talk about Starbucks and all that. But if you look at coffee consumption in this country, if you look at milk consumption in the country, you know, per capita just goes down, 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 year after year after year after year. And I think it's pretty clear what people like to drink once they get used to it. And with the price, is when I was born in 1930, a 6.5-ounce Coke cost a nickel, and you put a two-cent deposit on the bottle. But forget about that. Just take the nickel. Now you buy a 12-ounce can or a larger product, and you're paying, and if you buy it on the weekends at the supermarket specials or something, you're paying maybe a little more than twice per ounce what you were paying in 1930, 70 years ago. And compare that to the price behavior of almost any product, you know, that you can find, except raw commodities, but compare it to cars, housing, anything. And there's been very, very little price inflation in it. And I think that's contributed, of course, to the growth in per capitas over time. Charlie, how about cereals and soup?
Well, I think those are examples where the moats got less hostile for the competitors. Part of the trouble was the buying power got more concentrated and tougher. I mean, the big grocery chains now have a lot of clout, and then you add the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Sams and the it's a different world faced by the Kellogg's than the one they had 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, there will be a battle always between brands and retailers, because the retailer would like his name to be the brand. And to the extent that people trust Costco or Walmart more than they, or as much as they trust the brand, then the value of having the brand moves over to the retailer from the product itself. And that's gone on for a long, long time. Cases I know about in any real quantity were back with A&P in the 30s. And A&P, I believe, was the largest food retailer in this country, and they were also a big promoter of private labels. Ann Page, I think, was a big private label with them, for example. And they felt they could convince the consumer in the 30s that their brand meant more than having Del Monte on it or Campbell's or whatever it might be in the different categories. And people thought they were going to win that war for a while, and who knows? I mean, I don't know all the variables that went into the A&P's decline, but it was dramatic. I mean, it was a great American success story for a while, and then it was a great American failure. Charlie? Yeah.
The muscle power of the Sam's Clubs and the Costco's has gotten very extreme. A little earlier this morning when I was autographing books, a very good-looking woman came up to me and said she wanted to thank me. And I said, for what? And she said, you told me to buy this pantyhose I'm wearing from Costco. And I'd evidently made some previous comment about how amazing it was that Costco could get Hanes, of all people, to allow a co-branded pantyhose, Hanes-Kirkland, in the Costco stores. That wouldn't have happened 20 years ago.
She must have been pretty desperate if she was consulting with you on where to buy pantyhose, Charlie.